Yeah, sure thing.
Hey, you sold that car yet?
Yeah, sold it to Carvana.
Oh, I thought you were selling to that guy.
The guy who wanted to pay me in foreign currency, no interest over 36 months? Yeah, no. Carvana gave me an offer in minutes, picked it up, and paid me on the spot. It was so convenient.
Just like that?
Yeah.
No hassle?
None.
That is super convenient.
Sell your car to Carvana and swap hassle for convenience. Pickup fees may apply.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Chicago Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
One Heat Minute Productions presents Guide for the Film Fanatic, the podcast where we invite a guest to pick one movie from Danny Perry's seminal 1986 film reference book and talk to us about that movie. I'm your host, Jason Bailey, and across the mic and across the country from me is my co-host,
Michael Hull.
Our guest today, as you can imagine, we're pretty excited about. He is a film historian and sports writer, and his books include Cult Movies, Cult Movies 2, Cult Movies 3, Cult Movie Stars, Alternate Oscars, and of course, the reason we're here, Guide for the Film Fanatic. Please join us in welcoming our guiding light, the man, the legend, Mr. Danny Perry. Hello, sir.
Hello. Thank you so much for inviting me. It's after 40 years to have a book that's even remembered is great, but to be complimented like you guys do about this book, it's wonderful. Thank you so much.
Well, we really appreciate it. We appreciate you giving us, you know, your blessing to do this little show, and show our love for the book and for your work and for all of your scholarship. And I guess really that what I wanted to do most sort of in our opening segment here was just, you know, let's do an origin story. Let's talk about the book that is our Bible here on the show. Take me back. Where were you at in your career when you wrote Guide for the Film Fanatic, and what led you to want to write this specific book at that moment?
Well, my third book was called Cult Movies, and then I did the Cult Movies 2. And I was getting so much mail. Why didn't you include this film? Why didn't you include that film? Just overwhelmed by it. So I thought I'd come up with something that at least got them off my back. How about that?
Right. Well, because that's the thing, you know, if people haven't read them, and they should, that the Cult Movies books, each of those have what, like...
The first one had 100, which I wrote 100... Imagine writing 100 school essays in 1 year. I mean,
right.
So it was too much for me. So I said, it was a very successful book. I said, I'll do another, but 50 films. So I did the Cult 2, had 50 films, and people still weren't satisfied. They wanted more and more and more. And I thought Guide for the Film Fanatic was a way to do it. Originally, so you, instead of having 1,600 guests, originally I was going to have only 1,000 films in the book. And I just kept writing and writing and writing over that 1 year. I think I saw about 1,000 movies, or resaw most of them, and included 1,600 little blurbs about films, which I say little blurbs, but they were detailed.
Yes.
Little blurbs, yes.
Absolutely.
And the great thing about the book is, of course, my whole philosophy about writing is to get people to see movies. I encourage people to see movies, even movies that I don't like. And besides writing about 1,600 films, as you know, I have a checklist in the back of other films that every film fanatic should see. And I get mail, this is 40 years later, I get mail, I'm still working on the checklist. You know, they're checking off from the back. So
I got an email when we sent out the first sort of blast about the first episode going up from a former guest, David Fear, who's the film critic over at Rolling Stone. And he didn't know that we were doing the show, and he freaked out because he said this is his Bible, and he's down to about 10 more, and then he'll have seen everything. But he's been working on it for literally like 40 years.
I should shock him with a new list, you know.
Right when he's done, do some additions. What was the initial criteria for inclusion in the book? Like, what made you decide these are the initially 1,000, but ultimately 1,600 titles that you wanted to
hit? I'm actually trying to, when I did cult movies, the great thing about it was people would contact me and said, I didn't know anybody else knew about this movie that I loved. And that they were spreading the word. And that's kind of the impetus, I think, for the book, is to get people, I always try to mix, get people, highbrow people to like middlebrow and lowbrow movies, or give them a chance, and vice versa, the lowbrow people and middlebrow people to give highbrow films a chance. So what I love doing, including with cult movies, was mixing genres and mixing Citizen Kane with Behind the Green Door, that kind of thing. And that's kind of what made, you know, the mix is the exciting part for me too, because I'm somebody who sees everything, or I did at the time. Every genre I like, you know, I don't like specifically the genre, but I like a lot of movies within the genres. And the whole idea of a cult movies was creating a new genre, which is called cult movies. Before that, there was nothing that we mentioned cult movies, but there's no genre, and it was basically based on fans. All these films could be written about in terms of their fans, not just the actors and the directors and the whatever, but going backwards and through the fans. And Guide for the Film Fanatic was my real book to connect to readers. You know, it's just me talking to readers, and there's a lot of the word "I" is in there. It's very casual and very, I think, readable, and try to get people enthusiastic about films. And the whole idea is, what do I think was it every film person should see before they see everything else? But these are these are the really important films, according to me.
Yes. Now, one thing that we've already noticed in the few episodes that we've done so far is that there are movies in here that you do not love. That you might not even like that much. And that holds true also with some of the books in the cult, or some of the movies in the cult movie books. Yeah. Talk to us about that, because I know for some writers, for some critics, the idea of a canon is sort of limited to the things that they love. And you're not exclusionary like that.
Well, that's the great thing in terms of readers of my cult movie books, which and Guide for the Film Fanatic, is people did not get mad at me for not liking their favorite films. They would read what I wrote, and they disagree with me, because these are the films that they're most passionate about. They have their heart and soul invested in these movies, and they're telling everybody to see them. And I say, I didn't like it very much, but I explained why. But I would explain why, and that was the good thing. And the success of my books has to do with me not looking down on people who like movies I don't like. Just because I don't like Raging Bull doesn't mean a lot of people don't think it's one of the greatest films ever made. You know, is it my blind spot or their blind spot? It doesn't matter. It's an important film, you know, in film history. So that, something like The Wild Bunch. I like Ride the High Country. I'm a big Peckinpah fan. And I remember seeing The Wild Bunch and being disappointed in it because of the dialogue and some of the scenes. And I don't believe Warren Oates would have done what he did at the end. But anyway, so I explained all this, and people don't, I didn't try to change their minds, which is also a good thing. They could either take it or leave it. And that's what I think the success was. We're still on the same level, and I treated everybody and all those films with respect.
Yes.
The very first episode of this show that we did was with Roxana Haddadi, and she picked Godfather 2, in which you say Al Pacino is boring. Like, I mean, we really, you know, we sort of set this whole thing off.
I didn't remember I
said
that, yes.
I mean, you basically say, like, he's not very interesting. What makes it interesting is sort of the people around him. You say the same thing about De Niro, and that was shocking.
I like De Niro in that movie. I love the way he moves, in the flashback sequences. I thought he was really great. But it's funny that you say that me writing about Al Pacino being boring. So is it true?
Yeah. Well, it certainly inspired a lively conversation. Yeah. I mean, right? Like, is it true or is it not true? I mean, you made the point. Like, you're speaking your truth, and clearly you still believe that, right? So, but what it is whether or not you agree with it, there's something there. There are tangible opinions, statements, feelings, facts. There's something there to really hang on to and be able to chew on whether or not you agree with it. In the same way that you're saying whether or not you like the movie, you know, there's something there for people to grab a hold of.
Yeah,
starting with Godfather 2, it was an accidentally brilliant move. It was just such a stark example for everyone. Like, this is what this is what we're here to do. This is what Danny Perry does.
So you read my essay and the reaction was no, that's not right. So
and then we had a lively conversation about it, and that I do love the idea that, like, you can acknowledge that a movie is important, innovative, worth seeing, worth discussing, even if you don't love it. Like, that, I think that is a level of complexity and nuance that is too absent from contemporary film conversation, where everything is either the greatest movie ever made or an absolute piece of shit.
And just maturity also. Like, I don't really use that word. I don't know if I've used that word in 100 episodes of this show, but there's just a sort of our movie shows, but there's a maturity to the way that you approach these things. And like you say about not talking down to the audience, there's also a sort of assumption that, you know, I'll be able to see at least where your perspective comes from, even if I don't come to it. There's nothing sort of condescending about it either.
Nothing. Yeah.
I think that's another thing that is sort of unfortunately pretty common in criticism at this point, is a sort of condescending perspective that doesn't help me hear your point.
Well, you know, I grew up in the 50s, and I loved, like, every kind of, I loved Westerns most of all, but I also loved horror movies and science fiction movies, which were looked down upon. So we were always, you know, you're a little kid, what do you know about movies? You like, you know, like Invasion of the Body Snatchers and them and The Thing and whatever, but Incredible Shrinking Man. But what do you know? You're a little kid, and we don't like these movies, major critics. So I've always had that memory of just, critics didn't like the films young kids liked. And I never forgot that. So I defend people who don't like movies that I don't like.
That's great. Well, you know what, that idea of sort of genre movies and disreputability, I think, is a good transition to the conversation that we're going to have today. What film did you select to discuss on your episode of the podcast named after your book?
I Walked with a Zombie.
And out of their West Indian island comes a tale of terror and voodoo, of witchcraft and zombies, and all the weird black magic that the white man seldom sees.
It is a tale. They knew how to sell a movie back then.
And their love for a woman who lived with the dead. And it is also the tale of a young nurse who never believed.
I feel like there were probably a lot of black people in America that were like, I've never seen that shit either. I want to see this. Were there zombies in Chicago?
Zombies everywhere. The movie Zombies on Broadway, I think, if you remember. Remember that one?
Yeah, now, yeah.
This is the ceremony of voodoo death, a ceremony that seeks the life of the woman who lives forever, who walks with the dead.
That's how you sell your movie right there.
Well, the thing about the trailer, I actually know about the trailer. I interviewed the editor of I Walk with a Zombie. We should set up who Val Lewton is for people, because still people don't know. But this is one of nine low-budget horror films that Val Lewton's unit made it at RKO Studios in the 40s. And Val Lewton is this very erudite person, Russian born, and he was stuck making these horror films, but he had a lot of what we were talking about before, respect. He had respect for the audience and respect for the horror films, and he made nine terrific horror films, starting Cat People, I Walk with a Zombie, and The Leopard Man are the first three by Jacques Tourneur. I won't name all the films, but Ghost Ship, Isle of the Dead, Curse of the Cat People, and The Body Snatcher, and Bedlam, and I think, and The Seventh Victim. So I named them all. But anyway, I have to
just
promise you not to. But the point is,
if you're listening and not watching, for the record, Mr. Perry did not need to pull up IMDb to do that. That was off the dome for us.
So I've seen them, but they were all low budget movies, and the studio wanted to make money, and towns around America. The only way to sell your film was through the trailer and to have one sheets outside the theater. And those two things were what resulted in whether your film made money or lost money. And so the studio, although Val Lewton was making these very interesting existential horror movies, intellectual horror movies, the studio still away from him would make these lurid trailers trying to get people to see them.
Yep.
And the only thing he was good, they did the print on the one sheets and stuff. He did all that. He made sure that it wasn't that the fuzzy ones that made horror movies, you know, with the exclamation point. He made it seem very respectable. So anyway, those are the nine films that I Walk with Zombies, the second of nine terrific films, horror films, out of 11 films that he produced. He's a producer, as auteur, and he put this unit together. It included Mark Robeson and Robert Wise, who were editors for Orson Welles, and they got demoted after Magnificent Amberson. They fixed it, and they got demoted and put part of the horror unit, and Jacques Tourneur, who Val Lewton had met at MGM working with David O. Selznick, came in to direct, and he's this fabulous director. His father was Maurice Tourneur, and he was a great silent movie director, and Jacques Tourneur, if you watch I Walk with a Zombie, has all these really spooky silent passages of people walking and through in the dark and hearing sounds and whatever. The great thing of I mentioned sounds. We never hear about sounds in horror movies. It's one of the strange things. Ty West is the only guy who actually pays attention to sound. Since Val Lewton, but all the Val Lewton films have sound effects, and that's how in the darkness. And I Walk with a Zombie is no exception. That is part of what they're not jump scares, but we get frightened by the sound, the darkness, and people walking through wilderness and what's lurking behind in the darkness. So it's really good. I Walk with a Zombie to inform people, viewers, it's a combination. It's actually the Jane Eyre story. It's called the Jane Eyre in the West Indies. It takes place on a fictional island called St. Sebastian. And it's about a nurse who goes to take care of somebody on a plantation. And she's comatose. Now, is she a zombie is the question. But or is she insane? And the nurse, inexplicably, falls in love with one of the two brothers who run the plantation, And the two brothers, one is married to the commentator woman. That's who she loves. But apparently the comatose woman also loved the brother, and they were about to run off together. And then the mother of them got so upset, she went to voodoo, did some voodoo, and all of a sudden the woman was comatose. So this is the setup for this movie. But it
got it.
All the themes for Val Lewton, which are really fascinating.
Now, the story, to give a little more context, the story goes that I read, that was that Lewton was given the title by RKO executives, who had taken it from a magazine article by Inez Wallace, written during a reporting trip to Haiti. The screenwriters, by the way, were Kurt Siodmak and Ardell Ray, who had also penned the next Lewton Turner joint, The Leopard Man, which you mentioned, which came out later in the same year as this one, 1943. And Siodmak, as you may recall, listeners, was one of the writers of People on Sunday, which you can hear us discuss with Catherine Stebbins on the 1930 episode of A Very Good Year. As Mr. Pryor mentioned...
I should interrupt, because Kurt Siodmak's script was thrown away.
Oh.
Ardell Ray is like the unsung hero of this whole group, of one female writer with a group, and she was always part of it. And among the things she did is she bought the voodoo doll, but she also, I mentioned that they did a lot of research. I didn't mention they did a lot of research before doing these horror movies. They looked at a lot of art, and they read a lot of books, especially illustrated books, and they went to some locations. Inez Wallace, for instance, went to New Mexico to film streets, which were then went and they made The Leopard Man using all her photographs. But anyway, the interesting thing about Ardell Ray, which people don't know her, she later wrote for 77 Sunset Strip and whatever, but in the 1930s, she had a relationship with Dalton Trumbo.
Oh.
And people don't know if it was sexual or not. It probably was. But she apparently started to write a script for Johnny Got a Gun, which Dalton Trumbo ended up making in 1971. And the interesting thing about that is, if you remember, it's about this guy, a soldier who was shot and lies comatose in a bed. And it's the same as in I Walk with a Zombie. We don't know if this person is alive or dead. And which is one of the big themes of all Val Lewton movies, like between life and death. There's not a big gap. And I Walk with a Zombie is not an exception to this. There's a thing you probably don't even pay attention the first few times, but they talk about Saint Sebastian being where slaves are buried. The nurse arrives and says how beautiful this is, but the black coach driver will tell her, if you say so, but there's slavery that took place there, and all the slaves are dead, and they're living on this. This world as a graveyard is a major theme of all Val Lewton movies, and there are a lot of scenes, The Leopard Man, The Body Snatcher, and Isle of the Dead, which actually takes place on a battlefield with dead people and a graveyard. People are living on top of dead people. That's a theme of a lot of the Val Lewton movies. Body Snatchers about unearthing dead people and then killing people to save the living, as the doctor wants to save the living. So this is the real theme of these movies, the living. It's hard to live, because you have all these characters have bad pasts. Lewton is interested in history of not just the history and culture of the various locations. He puts all these low budget movies in, including this island, but just moving through they're all dead people around them. And the other part of the theme is death is seductive. All these people see death ahead of them, bad past behind them, and that little little place in between is, it's hard to live. And that's a theme that's in Seventh Victim is the real one. It's almost the Camus thing. You don't fear death, you fear life. And all the, and then a lot of characters, including the character played by James Ellison at the end, commit suicide. There are all these suicides through, and Seventh Victim ends with a double suicide, and it's hard to live. And it all comes from a John Donne poem, I run to death, and death meets me as fast, and all my pleasures are like yesterday. And but the John Donne poem, if you read it farther down, he's talking about hope and how you should live. And that's the big test. Can I live? And a lot of these characters, we see the zombie, we think are they dead or are they alive? But a lot of the characters, including the two brothers, are kind of living dead people. They're all cynical and they have no hope for the future. And they mention, and Tom Conway's character, who she falls in love with for no reason, just talks about death all the time. So it's really interesting. How do you live in this kind of world where you're on top of dead people and there are graveyards everywhere? And it's a very cynical view, and it's people being trapped, and it's all part of film noir. These films are filmed, it's the fatalism of these films in the 1940s. It's in the Val Lewton films, along with, in this film, Greek tragedy and horror and whatever. And it's the whole thing is, has God abandoned us? There's a battle between superstition and science, and there's a battle between Christianity and paganism in a lot of the Lewton films, and particularly in I Walk with a Zombie. Instead of paganism, it's voodoo, but they mention a couple of the pagan gods that the voodoo worshippers are worshiping.
Right.
So it's
right.
Greek tragedy. That's the other part of them.
Right. Well, and I want to delve into that a little more. Before I do, there's a piece of the show that we typically do, that it feels remiss to skip, even though it's a little bit redundant, which is that we typically have Mike read the entry from Guide for the Film Fanatic on the film in question. So let's just...
So now I have to read Danny Perry to Danny Perry?
To Danny Perry, yes.
I will now take back everything I said about the plot, so you go ahead.
But Mike, what does our guest Danny Perry say about I Walked with a Zombie in Guide for the Film Fanatic?
Back in 1986, I said...
Danny says... The most poetic of horror films. What a great start. Yeah. I'm going to start again. I'm just going to have to back that up. What a great start. The most poetic of horror films. Beautifully directed by Jacques Tourneur. How did you say his name?
Tourneur.
Okay. Beautifully directed by Jacques Tourneur for producer Val Lewton. It's their follow-up to Cat People. One of Lewton's brave, strong heroines, Frances D, is a Canadian nurse who goes to Haiti to work for planter Tom Conway, taking care of his sick wife, Christine Gordon. The natives believe Gordon is a zombie, one of the walking dead, and her lifeless appearance even during movement seems to confirm their suspicions. Is she insane, as Conway believes, or is her zombie-like state the result of a voodoo curse placed on her by Conway's mother, Edith Barrett, for having had an affair with James Ellison, Conway's half-brother? We never find out for sure. What we come to realize is that there is just as much validity in believing in the powers of voodoo as there is in believing God will answer prayers. Lewton does not belittle the island blacks by mocking their beliefs, customs, and religious practices. They are the ones who understand what forces reign supreme, while the whites wallow in confusion and terror.
Good line.
Damn, that's good. That's good stuff. Luton was a Bronte scholar, and in essence, this film was meant to be Jane Eyre in the West Indies. The story itself is set up like a Greek tragedy. A house has been ripped asunder by infidelity, meddling in-laws, sibling rivalry, and calling on pagan gods to carry out selfish bidding. There's even a one-man Greek chorus, black calypso singer Sir Lancelot, to explain the plot in song. This is the most visually impressive of Luton's films. The lyrical quality of the long silent passages, Dee and Gordon's nocturnal walk through the mysterious woods, Ellison carrying Gordon toward the ocean while a giant zombie, Darby Jones, follows, the shadows, the lighting, the music, the exotic settings, contribute to making this one of the masterpieces of the genre. Luton, Tourneau, and cameraman J. Roy Hunt have created the ultimate beautiful nightmare. Mark Robson edited, Kurt Siadmak and Ardell Ray based their script on a story by Inez Wallace, who claimed she really saw zombies in Haiti. Also with James Bell, Richard Abrams, Teresa Harris. Hell yeah, I'm watching that movie.
There we go. All right, so let me ask the big question for us, which is, out of all of the movies in the book, at 1600 plus, why did you choose this one, aside from the fact that you obviously have, you know, quite a lot of affection for it, to talk about with us?
I actually have an answer for that. So, good. I was a Val Luton fan from the time I was in the preteen. I'd seen The Leopard Man. I saw all his movies and didn't know who, it was all the same guy producing them all. Right. I liked them all. But then I became a real fan, and when I went to University of Wisconsin, they had the whole collection of Val Luton movies there. So as an undergrad, I resaw all of them, and then I went to USC Film School, and one of my professors was Arthur Knight, who wrote The Liveliest Art, which was one of the big films about the history of film at the time, and you know, anybody who wrote about movies at that time, we mistakenly thought were gods. So I had a class with him, and we had to write an essay about any film, and that time we didn't have internet or anything. We couldn't really see movies. So the one film that I really loved, that I knew all about, I could write about, was I Walk with a Zombie. So I wrote a long essay and gave it to Arthur Knight, and he said this should be published. And at the time, there was a guy named Joel Siegel who wrote a book about Val Luton. So I was disappointed because I wanted to write the book on Val Luton.
Of course.
But I came up with the idea of cult movies, and I had to write a sample chapter.
Oh wow.
In order to sell the book, and you know what film I picked, I Walk with a Zombie. I had the essay, I repolished it, and so I was able to write cult movies because of I Walk with a Zombie. So there's your answer.
That is a spectacular answer,
makes me have for this movie.
Yeah. Well, now I do too. For that,
I would just like to also note, like, one of the things that you just said in that answer is, I came up with the idea of cult movies. And I know that you were talking specifically about that book, but you were also talking generally about that thing that is now, I mean, it's just one of those things. Sure. It's like fucking Kleenex or Coca-Cola. It's just, you know, it's like, if you are interested in movies, even the slightest bit more than your average cousin, right, you know what you have a very specific understanding in mind of what somebody means when they say cult movies. Even if you've never seen them, even if you don't particularly like them, you know what that thing is. Even if you don't drink Coke, you know what it is. You've had it before. Everybody else you know likes it. It's just like, I came up with the idea for cult movies. That's just a thing you can say and not actually like give any more thought to, because that wasn't the point of your sentence. I didn't mean to stop this whole conversation.
What I would say, if you look at all of my titles, there are a lot of impossible books in there that I did, and a lot of the anthologies are impossible. I can't believe I did them. But I, in terms of cult movies and some of the others, I would say there should be a book on cult movies called Cult Movies. It should be a book. And I'm going to be the person to do it, and that's with a lot of my books. There's a gap there, and there should be a book.
that's the way to do it. This is a film that has become, I feel like, quite respected, specifically in recent years. Like, in fact, it was recently added to the Criterion Collection, just got a beautiful new 4K Blu-ray release, along with another Luton movie that you mentioned, The Seventh Victim. Did it have any sort of reputation or respectability when you were writing about it in Guide and in Cult Movies? Or was this movie still sort of waiting to be discovered at that time?
It wasn't as popular as it is now, for sure. Yeah. It's gotten the reputation, and I hope I have something to do with it. You know, because I raved about it in two books. I raved about this. And I've been writing about Val Lewton in ways, in different ways. Body Snatcher, I wrote a book called Alternate Oscars, where I picked who should be the best actor and best actress and best picture every year. And I gave my Oscar to Boris Karloff for Body Snatcher as the best actor.
Nice.
So many people are grateful for that one because he deserved it. For
he did.
One thing. So, yeah. So that's, you know, that's what I try to do. I mean, as I said over and over, I just want people to be exposed to these films that had such an impact on me. And Val Lewton, he's my baby almost. I mean, I've been, you know, championing his name forever. And it's interesting that he has become so well known among every horror fan knows Val Lewton nowadays. When I wrote this book, he wasn't that well known. And when I wrote the cult movie book, he wasn't that well known. But I must say that back when the films, Val Lewton's films were coming out in the 40s, this is during the war, and they have no male heroism in any of these movies, which is like fascinating. They were getting good reviews from like James Agee, who's like the main reviewer of Time magazine, and Manny Farber later liked one or two of the movies. I was the one who liked all the movies, but he was getting some attention. And even back then, but obviously not a lot. And then his films started appearing on television, but nobody could put them together. That this is the Val Lewton, you know, we're all into directors and the auteur theory and whatever, but he was a producer. So
a lot of
people got to like him through Jacques Tourneur because he's considered, you know, a great auteurist director.
One of the, you know, you mentioned, you know, that when he's running the RKO horror unit, he's working with these very low budgets. And, and I feel like we should expand on that just a little bit more, because the thing that's fascinating about that is because he didn't have the money for monsters, for expensive makeup effects, you know, that these were so, the budgets were so low that he and his directors had to do so much scaring the audience purely with mood, with light and with dark and with shadows rather than expensive effects. And I think like the first tower scene in this one is really kind of where you see that. But like in general, that was sort of the MO, was like, how can we frighten an audience without showing them anything that we have to spend money on? Is that roughly accurate?
Yeah, well, I know that you like to point out flaws in movies. So I think the whole impetus behind all these meetings between all the writers and the director and the producer, who's Val Lewton, which went on late at night, were how do we cover up flaws? What is the way we do it? What is the way we make it not look like a low budget movie? And if you I interviewed Mark Robeson, I mentioned before, and he talked about how Lewton agreed with Orson Welles in the sense that they were into detail. Every single thing was figured out, you know. Everything on the walls of like the Simone's apartment would have little cat things all over the apartment, you know, in the background, and it looked like she really lived there and whatever. And and I Walk with a Zombie, if you walk the scene where the characters go into I'm putting myself in a corner here because I don't know what that woman was doing, but people go into a museum and outside the museum is just a native woman doing some kind of something but it gives you a flavor of the town and mm-hmm. and they have the scenes that take place in the Caribbean town, and you just see all the different stores have names on them and people are going back and forth. It looks like their daily lives, and you didn't have to do all this stuff. It's a horror movie, for goodness sake, you know, but you want it to be good. And they Bedlam is all, there's a thing called Rake's Progress by Hogarth, a painter, and every shot in Bedlam, probably not every shot, but is taken from this Rake's Progress. You know, they transported great art into the visuals we're seeing. So he did that with every film, and he covered it up. You never think, you every once in a while you say this is clunky dialogue or whatever, and I say, why does she fall in love with that guy, you know?
Right.
It makes no sense, because you will see in these Val Lewton movies, which I said are made during the war, and you want to have these macho heroes. There aren't any. And they're kind of bland. He casts bland actors who, you know, Kent Smith is a leading man in two right. of his films. Mark Kramer. Who's Mark Kramer? I don't know.
Right.
James Ellison, who gets top billing in this, is a, you know, his big thing is he played in Hapalong Cassidy movies. He was a sidekick. Later on, he made a lot of B movies. He was wasn't in a lot of big movies. I think he's in The Plainsman. I think he played Buffalo Bill. But we forget about them. We remember the women in all these movies, and where they live and what they think and what they're doing, what is driving them. And really, again, they see death in the future. And should I try to live? Is there a reason to live? Hope. And that's, mm-hmm. and it's very cynical. Even I Walk with a Zombie, if you look at the last shot of after the suicide, I don't really want to give away the end of the movie, but the romantic leads are standing there looking over as the dead bodies come in, and they can now be together, but like in the Jane Eyre, they can be together because the insane or the zombie woman is dead, and the man is now a widower. You look right next to him is the mother of the two boys, grown adult men. She's crying, and that's the last thing we see of them. There's a crying woman there, and that's how this movie ends. Bedlam, the final film in the series made after the war, 1946. There's hope at the end. They get rid of the person who runs the insane asylum, and there's a great female character played by Anna Lee Nell Bowen, who, and it changes mental institutions, and there's hope. And that's the one really bright ending of any of the movies. It's the one that lost money. That's the film. All the others made money, and that didn't. And that's a great movie. See Bedlam. Yeah.
Right.
I mean, talking about them, I get enthusiastic. That's how good they are. They're all like, you know, the cult movies, everything's about discovery. You discover a film, and then you have to see it again and spread the word. That's how I Walk with a Zombie is for people who hadn't seen it before. Say, hey, this is different. There's like no other movie. All the Val Lewton movies are different. The easy thing to say is most of them have female leads, female characters. And you look before horror movies prior to that, wasn't like that. Cat and the Canary and the silent film, about the only one. Every other one had men. So it's women. He changed everything, and it's these nine films don't fit into any category or anything. They're just all different.
All right, friends, let's talk about the release and reception of I Walked with a Zombie, which opened in New York City on April 30th, 1943. Also opening that day was Sherlock Holmes in Washington, the fifth of the Basil Rathbone Nigel Bruce series. Moviegoers that day could also see Mission to Moscow, Air Force, Hitler's Children, Edge of Darkness, Desert Victory, Disney's Saludos Amigos, Jack Benny as the meanest man in the world, and Abbott and Costello in Ain't That Hay. And Casablanca was still in theaters from the end of 1942, as was that year's re-release of Chaplin's The Gold Rush. Mike, what were the news headlines on that day?
Friday, April 30, 1943, we were deep in the fight against fascism. Huh. The big news in the U.S. was a miner strike, like guys who dig in the ground for minerals. Nobody cared what kids thought in 1943. Anyway, The miners were striking for better pay and et cetera, the stuff people usually strike for. But President Roosevelt was hearing none of it. He basically ordered the guys to go back to work during negotiations, and they were all like, does this guy even know what a fucking strike is?
All right.
One fascinating piece of World War II history that not even your uncle knows. At one point, the U.S. ran out of olive drab paint for their Jeeps. You know, the green color they painted everything, right?
Yeah.
So they're...
Your old or broken phone can let you down when you need it most.
Perfect.
But at Verizon, trade in any old phone from our top brands and get the most for it, up to $2,000 in value, for an amazing new iPhone 16 Pro with Apple Intelligence and a new line on my plan, and iPad and Apple Watch Series 10. That's like a 3-for-1. And you can get it on any plan. At Verizon, trade in your old phone for a brand new iPhone 16 Pro, iPad, and Apple Watch. The other guys won't give you that. Visit Verizon.com today. Additional terms apply. Service plan required for Apple Watch and iPad. Up to $2,000 value based on iPhone, iPad, and Apple Watch. For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on Unlimited Welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Chicago Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on Unlimited Welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
All you homeowners have unique needs. Some feel the need to leave up holiday decorations year-round. Others have the need to use their garage as practice space for their new metal band. And because each homeowner has unique needs, GEICO helps you get the right coverage for your home and what's in it. That way, you get exactly what's right for you, even if your needs are unique. Get more with GEICO.
They're asking if anybody had any extra laying around, and the Brits gave them some buckets of an old light brown, like a desert, you know, type of brown that they weren't using. Turns out that as it deteriorated, the tan-colored paint was becoming pink. So there was at least one American division driving pink Jeeps for a while in 1943. Apparently, some of the guys thought it was pretty. Yeah. And finally, on April 30, 1943, it was reported in the New York Times. This was news that made the real paper. Okay. That Charles Dickens' grandson sunk a U-boat for Britain, and that the U.S. Army was accepting donations of dogs to go fight in the war. There was not a follow-up story that said how it went for the dogs. Lots of war in 1943, as one would expect. That's headlines. Jason, what did critics say about I Walked with a Zombie?
Well, the Times' Tom Pryor was not a fan, writing, quote, "With its voodoo rites and perambulating zombie, I Walked with a Zombie probably will please a lot of people, but to this spectator at least," oh, this is a good one, "it proved to be a dull, disgusting exaggeration of an unhealthy, abnormal concept of life. If the Hays office feels it has a duty to protect the morals of moviegoers by protesting the use of such expressions as hell and damn in purposeful dramas like In Which We Serve and We Are the Marines, then how much more important is its duty to safeguard the youth of the land from the sort of stuff and nonsense that their minds will absorb from viewing I Walked with a Zombie." And you know what? I'm sure he thought that was a pan, but damn, I'll bet that got some people into the seats. The New York Herald Tribune was similarly unimpressed. "This RKO radio chiller combines voodooism and logic, and it might be added, logic comes off second best. Despite the efforts of Kurt Siodmak, that expert purveyor of horror films, as one of the scenarists, I Walk with a Zombie relies chiefly upon eerie lighting effects to achieve its frightening aspects." It's like, okay, and yeah. Correct. But as Mr. Perry mentioned, some of the more enlightened critics of the time, including James Agee and Manny Farber, felt much more affectionately towards it. How did it do in terms of box office and awards, Mike?
The thing about movies from 1943 is that we don't have easy access to box office numbers, which weren't nearly as widely reported. But we do have a Hollywood Reporter item from February of 1943, which reported that because of the success of Cat People, I Walked with a Zombie would not be rented to theaters on a flat rate, as was the custom for B-movies, but on a percentage of the box office, as was the practice with higher budgeted A films. So, I mean, at least the distributors were given some
coin.
Respect.
Yeah.
I Walked with a Zombie didn't win any awards, but that Criterion 4K you mentioned was nominated just this year for a Saturn Award for Best Classic Film Home Media Release.
And
I mean,
richly deserved.
They still don't nominate movies like
they still,
this. They were,
correct.
I mean, right?
Correct.
It was never going to happen.
And that's why we write about them in books.
It was RKO's biggest grosser of the year.
There we go.
Yes.
There we have it. All right. Now it's time for a segment we call Double It Up, where we each select one movie that we think would make an ideal double feature with today's focal film. Danny Perry, you're our guest, which means you go first.
I go first. Well,
yes, sir.
I think it's a pretty easy choice. Jacques Tourneur, after his three films with Val Lewton, was one of the few people who was actually respected by the high brass at RKO, and he got a couple of more films, Berlin Express, and the big one is Out of the Past, which is one of the great film noir classics of all time.
Yes.
But he went on into the 50s, and he didn't make any more horror movies until 1957, Curse of the Demon, also called Night of the Demon, which is a terrific film, which he goes back to all the things he learned or did in the Val Lewton movies with the silent walks and the sane or insane characters and witchcraft as opposed to against Christianity and paganism. And it was written by Charles Bennett, who wrote a lot of the Alfred Hitchcock movies of the 1930s, including 39 Steps and Sabotage and Young and Innocent, and then in America, Foreign Correspondent. And they always have, all the Hitchcock movies always have great villains, and they're always smart villains. And this one has really a smart villain. And in my opinion, Charles Bennett hated the monster, the demon, the giant demon in this movie. I think it's a great demon. I think it's one of the great monsters. One of the things with the Val Lewton movie, he's famous for not showing monsters, but having shadows of them and whatever.
Sure.
So you're never sure what you see. And Charles Bennett didn't want to have this monster shown in the studio, imposed it. And there was a book I think I mentioned, because I included this writing about this in Cult Movies 3, is how Carlos Clarins wrote a great horror book, like the best book, the Illustrated History of Horror, terrific book. And inside he writes about how he doesn't like this demon. It's a terrible demon, you know, it's too big and whatever. And the cover of the book is the demon from so I like it, but it has all these things, the old science versus superstition, where a psychiatry, which was a Val Lewton thing, and he put in his movies in the 1940s when you weren't really making films about psychiatry. And we have in this film a guy hypnotizing people. So he's doing the science thing, and meanwhile there's a seance. There's always these two things. Like in I Walk with a Zombie, you have the doctors doing things, injections, and then you have a voodoo witch ritual where they're stabbing a person in the comatose woman in the arm. The same thing, the injection into the arm. Science versus superstition. The same thing is that. And it's a terrific movie with Dana Andrews and Peggy Cummins of Gun Crazy, one of the terrific film noir films. So, great. So it's her second best film. So
there you go.
It's totally good. So that's would be the perfect thing. And Robert Wise came back with The Haunting a few years later using some of the same techniques. And but I'll still go with Curse of the Demon because people don't know that as well, and I want people to see it.
There we go. Mine is a little bit of a no-brainer, I must confess. You know, after I got done rewatching this movie for this episode, I was piddling around doing some stuff. I put on Cat People again, which I've seen a bunch of times. You know, was just kind of in a Luton mood, enjoyed it very much. And then I put on Curse of the Cat People, which I was certain I'd seen, and then had that moment, I'm sure you've had it as well, about 10 minutes in where you're like, nope, I have never seen this. I was thinking of something else. I mixed it up with something else. So I watched Curse of the Cat People for the first time about a week ago and knocked my socks off. It's Robert Wise was the director on this one, who, as you mentioned, sort of came into the fold after Trenor. It is that what I was most surprised by, especially watching it immediately after Cat People, is that the tone and approach is quite different. It is a continuation in many ways, but it's, I think, even more of a sort of psychological study than even the sort of horror supernatural thriller mode that the first Cat People is working in. Because of that, there's a sort of a good unsteadiness to the narrative. You're not sure where it's going. You're not sure where they're going to go. They're trotting sort of unfamiliar ground here. And that's always thrilling when you're watching a genre movie and you still don't know where it's going to go. I will also add that it runs something like 68 or 70 minutes. Like, all of these movies are incredibly short. So if you have a short attention span, or you're just looking for a movie to throw on like late at night and you don't want to be up too late, all of these Luton movies are nice, breezy. They're barely longer than, you know, an episode of The Walking Dead or whatever show you're watching. Mike, what is your choice for a good double feature?
My choice was inspired by a particular line from the review in the book, where it says, Luton does not belittle the island blacks by mocking their beliefs, customs, and religious practices. They are the ones who understand what forces reign supreme while the whites wallow in confusion and terror. And that reminded me more than anything else of The Serpent and the Rainbow, Wes Craven movie.
Oh, shit.
That is, zombie, like Haitian voodoo, all that business, you know. But it's like, it's maybe the only Wes Craven movie or even horror movie that's the cast is mostly black. Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, so like, it doesn't follow the Scream rules as far as black characters go, because it can't, because everybody in the movie is black except for the two white people who are confused. You know, and sort of, right? And so you get this real sort of wide swath of good guys, bad guys, you know, sort of all the guys, all the different sort of movie characters are filled by black people in the movie. And thus and so, he does not belittle the island blacks by mocking their beliefs, customs, and religious practices, right? I mean, it's like, when I read that, when I because I don't like to read... Or no, I don't even want to watch a trailer or see a poster if I know I'm going to watch a movie, right? I didn't actually read this till after I had watched I Walked with a Zombie. But that was the first thing that came up. Yeah. So then I went and watched Serpent and the Rainbow again just to make sure I wasn't out of my mind. And no, it's a great movie. I mean, it's a Wes Craven movie, he was sort of at the peak of his abilities. And it's a really good film. And, you know, you don't know what the hell is going on. And the white guy definitely doesn't know what the hell is going on or whether or not he's going to make it out of here, you know.
Yes.
My double up is Serpent in the Rainbow. Good movie.
I will only add, just so we don't get emails, just a reminder, Craven did also direct People Under the Stairs and Vampire in Brooklyn. So
yes,
he took a
I'm
couple
sorry,
of,
he made a lot of movies. I forget sometimes. It didn't just go straight from Freddy to Scream, you know.
Nah, not adverse to working with all black cast. So good for him. Mr. Perry, where can people follow you on social media, if anywhere?
Nowhere. Occasionally, if requested to do a podcast like you guys and it sounds good, I will do it. I'm basically retired, which is great, right? So, and so that's where they can meet me. You know,
great.
You know, you can read my stuff everywhere. My books are hard to find. They're all out of print. They have lots of printings, though. You'll find them. You can find all my stuff. Yeah.
You can find them all on the used books.
Easy e-books. Yes. And including what I wrote about all I Walk with the Zombies in the a horror ebook.
Yes. A-books, eBay, you can find the books that are out of print, but the cult movies books were sort of reconfigured into genre specific ebooks and made available a few years ago, and those are definitely worth picking up and reasonably priced.
Thank you. Yes.
I'm Jason Dash Bailey on Blue Sky and Letterboxd. Mike, where can people find you?
I am Fifth Column Films on Blue Sky, where I'm going to be posting pictures of one of the model buildings from Blade Runner.
Okay.
Wow.
So
pretty cool looking.
On that. Yeah, I'll bet. And of course, if you like the show and you think other people might like it too, please do leave us a rating and a review on your podcatcher of choice. Also, if you'd like to join our mailing list and get weekly show notes and such, you can do that at buttondown.email/filmfanatic. If you'd like to make a donation to support us on the show, you can do that at ko-fi.com/funcitysounds. And again, if you're one of those freaks who likes to watch videos of people recording a podcast, you can find us on YouTube. And the name of the channel, again, is Danny Perry Rocks.
Our humblest thanks once again to you, Mr. Danny Perry, author of Guide for the Film Fanatic. We do this at the end of every show. We're not going to skip it just because you're here. Thank you very much for writing the book, for gifting everyone, like basically everyone's movie personality at this point. I mean, the idea of combining like low and high in one appreciator is everybody's movie personality at this point. And you invented it. I just thank you. And yes. Shout out to executive producer Blake Howard. Things that are natural to him might shock and horrify you.
Thank you again, Danny Perry.
Thank you for inviting me. It was a lot of fun. And what I can tell about both of you is you like to spread the word about films you like.
We do. Just doing our best to keep that going. Thank you, Mike.
Thank you, Jason.
And thank you for listening. Join us in 2 weeks when our guest is Violet Luca, film critic and author of the new book David Cronenberg, Clinical Trials. She'll join us to discuss The Dead Zone. See you then.
What is Dax, are you?
Tracking all our cars on Carvana Value Tracker on all our devices? Yes, Kristen, yes I am.
Well, I've been looking for my phone for...
In Dax's domain, we see all, so we always know what our cars are worth.
All of them?
All of them. Value surge, trucks up 3.9%.
That's a great offer.
I know. Sell?
Sell.
Track your car's value with Carvana Value Tracker today.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Chicago Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.